This is Dr. Richard Perron. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. John McNown, Jr. Today is December 17, 2003. I am again in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library Interview Room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. McNown is in Mission, Kansas. Sir, why don't we pick up where we left off? You had basically completed your first full day in Vietnam, and why don't we continue the narrative from there?
Okay, well, it was I was thinking about that. Matter of fact, I was reviewing a few notes that I'd taken while I was there this morning, just to be sure I had some things right. And that one of the things I guess is that would be worth talking about is that you didn't realize from, you know, having grown up watching movies and things, is just how miserable being an infantry soldier is. I think maybe in the latest Gulf War, they were showing more things about that because the reporters were actually out in the field with the troops again. Mm-hmm. But when I got to Vietnam, I was a little overweight. I'd partied for about 30 days before I got there. And in Quang Ngai province in August, it probably runs between 95 and 110 degrees in the daytime, and it doesn't drop much below that at night. And the mosquitoes are bad, and the heat's bad, and you're nervous. And one of the things that I remember is that you didn't get much sleep when you first got there. Between the mosquitoes, we had lots of indoctrination about what we were supposed to do to protect ourselves from malaria with mosquitoes, things using mosquito nets and insect, you know, repellent or anything, and they didn't issue you any of that stuff. And so you get out to the field, and you pretty much you have a poncho and a poncho liner, and no mosquito netting, no little insecticide stuff to blow around after you set your mosquito net up. And the mosquitoes were just terrible. I remember, you know, at night just trying to find some way to keep the buzzing in your ears from you know, annoying you so much that you could get some sleep. And we were carrying probably somewhere between 60 and 80 pounds a man. We, I know I talked to people in some units, and they would bring in a helicopter every night with their equipment and things on it, and they went around pretty light in the daytime. But we, everything that we had to carry on our back. So all your extra ammunition, your water. I think we were probably carrying about 2 gallons of water a man, because most of the stuff you couldn't drink. And we would carry anywhere from, I don't know, I think by the time I got out, and most of the people that had been there for a while were already doing this, we were carrying around 450 rounds of M16 ammunition and 100 rounds of machine gun ammunition, and then either a law or a mortar shell, and a claymore, and maybe 4 or 5 fragmentation grenades. And so by the time you got all done, most of your weight was either in ammunition or food. We'd carry 4 or 5 days worth of food, and it was all sea rations at the time. They hadn't come out with the what they call the long range patrol rations, or the MREs, I think is what they call them now. But that so everything was canned.
Okay.
So it was pretty heavy, and that's what I remember. I remember sitting down and then having to have somebody help me up off the ground, because I couldn't figure out how to get up with that load on my back. And, and that's a little embarrassing, you know, when you're 23 years old and you're in pretty decent shape and you can't get up, and it just takes you a while to learn to maneuver with that much weight on your back. But
can you tell me what your uniform was comprised of, what you personally, individually carried?
Yeah, I carried, well, when I first got there, I carried the 7 magazines. We'll start at the bottom. I had the pair of jungle boots and socks, and then they'd issue jungle fatigues. Everybody had jungle fatigues, and the webbing that with the pistol belt, and you had these this kind of yoke thing that went over your shoulders and stuff, and you could hang things off it. And I carried two quart canteens and 2 1-quart canteens. And then I got some more later on, because that just, you know, you just, water was something you really needed. So there was a lot of extra weight there, especially in the summer. carried, started off with 2 fragmentation grenades and ended up carrying 5, started off with the 7 magazines and ended up carrying 25 plus another 180 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, at first I carried 1 extra set of clothes. I got rid of those because they'd come out with resupply every week or so, depending on when they could get to us. And so it was just weight you didn't need. Would carry an extra pair of socks and try to keep them dry in a little plastic bag. Carried some writing material, smoke grenades, a knife, a bayonet, M16 rifle. They issued me a .45. I gave that to an M79 guy because they didn't give them .45s and they only had 1 shot. Most of them were worried about the fact that they didn't have much personal protection.
Right.
And I didn't like carrying a pistol because it kind of made you stand out from the other people.
Mm-hmm.
Some writing material, a map, a code book, because I was a platoon leader, and had my dog tag someplace, I guess. I never carried... You're supposed to lace them into your boots, And I think I taped mine up and kept them around my neck. I never liked looking at my dog tags when I was walking. It just seemed like a bad omen. And I got to the point that I was real, after I'd been there for a week or two, that I was really concerned about everything being exactly where it should be, that I would want the things in my pockets. I had a little 8 bamboo piece from a Mahjong set that was a keychain that I carried, my mom had given me, and a Ho Chi Minh penny that I picked up and some other things, and I'd want everything in the same pocket. And I'd be walking along and all of a sudden I realized that something wasn't in the right place, I would stop and move it so that things were exactly where they should be.
Now why did you do that?
I guess it gave you a sort of a sense of security, or that you were in control of something. I'm not exactly sure. It was almost like a superstition. If things were in the right place, that there was something more secure feeling about that, that you would know where everything was.
And
I think quite a few guys were like that. They would, you know, you do certain things every day after a while. And it takes a little while to get to that point, I think. But it didn't take too long. I think within a week or two, you got to where you wanted something that you thought you were, you know, sort of in control of. And I think that was pretty much the case for everybody. Everybody wore a helmet at the time. You didn't see any bush hats in the field, at least in our unit. Entrenching tools were very important things.
Right.
And then we would carry either a LAW, a light anti-tank weapon, or an 81 millimeter mortar round if the mortar people were out with us, because they couldn't, of course, carry all their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And 100 rounds of machine gun ammunition. Every man in the platoon carried 100, because I think the machine gun crews carried about 900 to 1,000 rounds, and then everybody carried extra ammunition for the machine guns, because
right.
that was really important for
right.
us.
Tell me about your weapons. You mentioned you carried the sidearm but then gave it away, but you had the M16.
Uh-huh.
Can you discuss that weapon and in the grenades and the other things that you had? Which ones did you prefer? Which ones did you not want to have?
The M16, I never fired an M16 until I got to Vietnam, because they were all, at the time, we were all still training with M14s in the United States. And so the first time I ever fired one was when I got to Chu Lai for training. And then they handed me a weapon out of the armory on my first day, which, I spent, as I think I mentioned earlier, about 4 hours in the rear area, where they were just handing me stuff and sticking it in his rucksack and sending me out. And I never actually got to fire the weapon until I was actually in combat, and I had no idea where the rounds were going. I'd never been able to, you know, to put a zero on it.
Mm-hmm.
Uh, And we used to, Sergeant Wright, my platoon leader, had been on machine gun committees at various posts and been a machine gunner in the Korean War. And he used to make us load, when we had time, every fifth round tracer. So at night that the M16s would look a lot like the M60 machine guns when they were firing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, in the daytime, if you didn't know where your bullets were going, about every fifth one you had an idea whether you were high or low. So it wasn't the worst idea in the world.
Right.
So we spent, a lot of time when we had time loading our magazines, setting that up so that at night if we got hit we'd protect the machine guns, which, is about 30 or 40% of your firepower and a lot of your...
Mm-hmm.
It's just really important to use your guns right. And then M16, I liked it. I only had it malfunction on me one time. Of course, we had the A1, so we had the second version. By 68, they had the newer ones out where they put the chrome in the chamber and around the bolt so they didn't stick as badly as they had in 66 and 67.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you kept them clean, it was a fine weapon. And the thing that I liked about it, the ammunition was light. It carried a lot of ammunition, whereas with an M14 or one of the early weapons, it would, you could probably only carry half as much. Then the fragmentation grenades, the first ones we had were the M26A1s, I think, with... They were shaped pretty much like the old pineapple grenades you saw in the World War II movies, only they were smooth. And they fit in your hand pretty well, and you could kind of put a spiral on them like a football and throw them pretty well. And then some genius in the Pentagon or someplace decided all Americans played baseball, and what they needed to be shaped like a baseball, so they came out with the M33, which was round, and we didn't like those nearly as much. We would trade them with the, they were a little smaller and a little bit lighter, and we would trade them to the South Vietnamese for the M26s, because when something that's is that heavy, it's a lot easier to throw with your whole hand than try to grip it like a baseball.
Right.
So we like, the fragmentation grenades when you were in close combat were a good thing. The M60 machine gun was a fine weapon. I mean, if you kept it clean, combat's a pretty dirty environment, but they were just, hardly ever malfunctioned and just an extremely good weapon. And the M79 grenade launcher, which was the other thing that we had at the, platoon level, nobody liked carrying it. The ammunition was heavy. It was a one-shot deal, and it was really sort of almost like a support weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was heavy and it had one shot, people just didn't, and the ammunition was heavy, they just didn't like carrying it. And so the new people usually got assigned to carry the M79. Very few people wanted to carry it after they'd carried it for a little while.
How long would those guys usually carry it before they realized this is not so good?
I think they figured it out immediately when some old guy would say, okay, you're the new grenadier and take your 16 when they showed up. It didn't take too long to figure out the people before you didn't like it.
Uh-huh.
And then we had some people that, occasionally you'd have somebody that did like it. They'd run around with the shotgun round and for initial stuff, and it was a good weapon for what it was designed to do. It just wasn't very practical. And of course now they have the over and under thing, I guess, where the person actually has a 16 and an M79 is sort of all in one piece, so they do have some personal protection. And,
right.
But that was the weapon that whenever we got really short of people, we wouldn't have any M79s in the field. We usually didn't have as many as the TONE called for. It called for two in each squad, and we usually had one.
Mm-hmm.
And we would try to fire them as a group if we could, if we were in an area where we could kind of put them together and use them sort of almost like mini artillery. And we did the same thing with the LAWs. We carried a lot of LAWs, and because of... A lot of time the NVA would wait till they were close enough to kiss you before they'd open up. mm-hmm. and you couldn't get artillery or airstrikes in,
mm-hmm.
And we'd use those almost like artillery. And we also carried a 90-millimeter recoilless rifle in the company. Each platoon was assigned one, but we only carried one in the company because, again, the ammunition, I think it weighed about 11.5 pounds for a round.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a flechette round with them, and
mm-hmm.
we carry two or three high explosive rounds, and we'd carry a few flechettes and carry one gun, one of the recoilless rifles in the company. And they came in pretty handy occasionally when things got real tough because they'd clear out a lot of brush and a lot of people if they got online. So it was a nice weapon. But I know a lot of the, I think a lot of the outfits didn't carry one. Captain Adams, our company, the first company commander, insisted that we carry one. And then I think later on they quit carrying it. But the whole time I was in the field, we had it with us.
Mm-hmm. What was your favorite weapon?
Far and away, the M60 machine gun. I mean, it was. I didn't fire it that much, but when it came to worrying about things, whether you had good people on the guns, I mean, the M60, was your firepower. That was the thing that gave you the edge if things got bad. And so you put good people on them, and you made sure that you had backup gunners and. Just really, when an M60 was in the hand of somebody who knew what they were doing, it's just an awesome piece of equipment. So,
do you think that was the most feared weapon that you all had out in the field from the standpoint of the NVA and the VC?
No question about that. I mean, they tried to take the machine gunners out. They were smart enough to know to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we did the same thing. A machine gun is in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing. It is a pretty terrible thing, really.
Right.
So.
What constitutes a good machine gunner in your eyes?
Most of the time we put guys on them that were pretty good size because it weighed 23 pounds and it would climb on you. And a lot of times, you know, we didn't use the tripods. You were using it almost like an automatic, a heavy automatic rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to have somebody who could hold the gun down while it was being fired.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have somebody who was really steady, that didn't lose their head, and was willing to had to be a responsible person. I mean, we never had somebody on the machine gun that wasn't just as steady as a rock. I mean, that was real because they actually had two other people on the gun team with them.
Mm-hmm.
You had an ammo bearer and an assistant gunner. And so they really had some responsibility there over that group. And then they had responsibility that when something started happening, they had to know how to react, and then they had to be willing to just take the heat. I mean, it was really important that the gunner remain steady and act responsibly, and no matter what happened, keep firing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so...
What weapon did you all fear the most that the enemy had?
Probably the one that you thought the most about was the AK-47s. I mean, they had more of them, and it was a no question. The AK-47 was a really good weapon, and in the hands of somebody who knew what they were doing, again, it was really good.
Mm-hmm.
But if we'd start running into 50 caliber machine gun, 51s actually is what they were using. Those things were scary, because the round was so big, and I mean it would just start cutting down trees and things, and so we probably, when you talk about what did we fear the most, it was probably the 51 caliber machine guns.
Did it have a distinctive noise that you all heard?
Yeah, it fired slow and it was very loud and had a low. Probably fired a rate about 450 rounds a minute, which isn't that slow, but it's still pretty slow, 400. And so you could hear the distinctive rounds coming out of it, and it was sounded pretty low, but it was pretty fast. And then the RPGs were bad also. I mean, that was a thing that they used very effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And they used it like we did laws. They used it almost like small artillery, that you'd just get whole barrages of RPGs coming in on you.
Mm-hmm. Was there a weapon that you did not have that you wished you did have with you?
We, for a while, we had 60-millimeter mortars that we'd done. We, that wasn't part of our table of organization. We had 81-millimeter, which was a large, heavy weapon with large, heavy rounds, and was really developed for Europe. And it wasn't very practical in the jungle and the rice paddies. And we got some 60-millimeter mortars. We traded them from the Vietnamese, and the Army took them away from us after they found out we had them after a while because it wasn't part of the table of organization. Mm-hmm. But we really liked those because you could carry the rounds, probably weighed half as much as a 81 round, and the tube was probably weighed as third. It was really a nice weapon. It was you could fire them off you could fire them off your knee.
Mm-hmm.
There was lots of things. I don't think anybody did that. It hurt, I heard, but a couple of them tried it. But anyway, it was a nice weapon to have in the fields. But as I said, we only had one for a little while, and then they took them. So,
were you all able to get resupplied adequately in the field and of course, back at camp when you went back?
When you were in a fire base, we didn't get back to camp much while I was in the field. And I only spent a little over 3.5 months in the field. I was very lucky. I spent most of my tour at brigade headquarters later on. We were in fire bases during that time, but we never got back to the brigade or division base camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that some of the guys were out there 9 months before they got back. We didn't have a stand down for almost 9 months one time.
Oh.
And I think they just forgot that we were out there sometimes. Yeah. And resupply was, I would say, sporadic. They used to tell us that we were going to get a hot meal once a day, and sometimes we'd go 3 or 4 days and get one, and then sometimes we'd go 2 or 3 weeks without one.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of just depended on the situation. And there were times when we were out in the mountains when the weather got bad that we didn't get resupplied adequately at all. We ran out of food for 2 days completely out one time.
Wow. What did you do?
Well, we just finally got on top of a mountain, cleared an LZ, and waited for the weather to clear.
Mm-hmm.
And some guys that had some peanut butter and things were auctioning it off. And they were looking for lizards to see if they were good to eat and things. But we literally had been out of food for 2 days before we got a resupply.
Wow. How did you handle that as one of the leaders?
At that time, I was actually company commander.
Okay.
And we were all in it together, and I wasn't eating, they weren't eating, and we were just sitting there waiting for resupply, and they knew it was raining, it was socked in, and that we couldn't, there wasn't anything to do but what we were doing. And the weather would clear pretty soon. They kept telling us it was going to clear, and it finally did, and then we had sort of a disaster. They had a new fellow. We were, like I say, out in the jungle it was pretty thick jungle, so we had a fairly small hole that we had cut in the trees for them to hover over and drop the resupply into.
Mm-hmm.
And this helicopter driver just was new, and he wouldn't hover. He had been told that you weren't supposed to hover. You could slow down. And they were coming by kicking these sea rations out from about 150 feet, 200 feet up, and they were just like missiles coming down. We actually had to dust a man off with a broken back.
Mm.
Had been hit by a sea ration case, and
wow,
and so it was just the whole little period right there was kind of a mess.
Mm-hmm.
We got in trouble. We actually shot at him because he came back to make the second pass, and we scared him off by shooting an M60 at him, and of course he reported us, and that wasn't good. We'd had one man hit an arm broken, and one man had his back broken by because the sea rations wouldn't hit the excuse me a second.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay,
so they had so anyway, it was just sort of it was real sporadic,
mm-hmm.
and they'd bring us ice cream, of course, and it would be all be melted by the time it got out to us and things like that. But
right.
But it was nice just to get something, you know, we'd pour it into canteen cups and it was still kind of cool and it would
mm-hmm.
be good.
Mm-hmm.
And the weather was when I first got there, it was August, and it was dry season, and I know it would get up, you know, the 110, 112
mm-hmm.
range, and they claimed it was hotter than that sometimes, but I don't know if it really was. But and then at night, it would cool off into the 90s, you know, low 90s.
Right.
And so, and then we were out in the mountains in November, and I think, you know, that was during the monsoon, and so you were wet. And I think the temperatures would be in the upper 50s, lower 60s,
mm-hmm.
and you just felt like you were freezing. We'd set up our ponchos sometimes when we were after we dug in, and take C4 and roll it in little balls and try to heat the inside of the light it with a match, and sometimes go through a pound or two of C4. And I found out later on that it cost, you know, like $200 a pound, so our heating bill was pretty expensive. Really, the fellows that spend all their time up in the Central Highlands, I thought that in the, during the monsoon, that must have been pretty miserable weather
mm-hmm.
up there, because
mm-hmm.
we were up there in November, and, you know, it just rained all the time, and
mm-hmm.
trying to climb mountains in the mud is just not much fun. So,
John, what would you, or how would you rate the morale of the men when you first arrived, and how that evolved over the time you were there?
Well, I think I got there, as I say, in late July of '68, and the morale, you know, and the only thing I can, you know, address is the morale in our particular unit, because that's really about the only
mm-hmm.
people I saw. But let me go back before that. At okay. Fort Carson, Colorado, which is where I was stationed before I went over.
Yes.
I was friends with some senior NCOs that had actually been in the Korean War, and, you know, were you know, professional soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were already disillusioned, and this would have been early 68, with just the way that things were going and the fact that, having been over there, that they thought, you know, that people really didn't want us there, and they just thought the whole thing was a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went over there thinking that, you know, it wasn't quite like they told us. When I got there, morale in the company was good. We had a good company commander, and I think morale in any unit has to do with the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Good squad leaders and just generally good infrastructure within the company. And so the morale was pretty good. And that went on, I think, the whole time pretty much I was in the field. But by late November, the morale wasn't quite as good as it'd been, because they'd stopped the bombing. And at that point of North Vietnam, as I remember, they stopped it early November of '68.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we knew that we were trying to negotiate our way out, and, you know, anybody with any brains. And people got to worrying about, well, how long is the war going to last, and, you know, what's the deal here? You know, we were over here getting shot at and losing people, and it's obvious that we're not, you know, we're going to pull out at some point.
How did you all know that in the field? Were you able to obtain the information through word of mouth?
Well, the Stars and Stripes would have the fact that, you know, we'd get newspapers occasionally out there,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Stars and Stripes, and they would, you know, say that, you know, we'd, as part of the negotiation things, had stopped the bombing in North Vietnam. And the other thing that happened sometime right after that,
mm-hmm.
the amount of activity in our area of operations started picking up. We were getting more NBA coming in, where there'd been fewer earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd actually pretty much, I think, taken care of by September. We'd pretty much blunted the post-test offensive that they had coming, you know, through there by in September, we had a pretty good size action out around Hawthorne Special Forces Camp in our area, and big action and pretty much decimated the NVA regiments that were out there, and then activity just really dropped off. I mean, you could just see that they were running, you know, deeper into the mountains every time you ran into some of them. They didn't want to stand and fight. You know, they would just fire a few rounds and take off, and you just couldn't find anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then by later on, by early February, they were just all over the place again. And that was pretty obvious to people, you know, that that the bombing, the halt in bombing in North Vietnam along the Ho Chi Minh Trail there for a while, was not working to our benefit. You would hear things. People would come in, new people from the States, you know, would be telling you things that were going on, and you could get radio stuff, and people would get letters, and so, you know. And rumors, there were always rumors going around. We heard Captain Rob over in Rob O'Company had a baby, and it turned out it was, you know, Captain Rob that was married to one of the Johnson girls.
right.
But you know, we were all calling him up and congratulating him on the radio, and he wanted to know what was going on. And we said, oh, we heard you had a baby, and that wasn't even married, so that was...
How much did you know, Captain Rob?
The Captain Rob and B Company. I didn't know Captain Rob that was married to Lyndon.
Okay.
This was a different Captain Rob.
Okay.
So
okay.
He was in Bravo First of the 20th, and I think Captain Rob was a Marine.
Yes, he was. Chuck Rob was.
Yeah.
You're exactly right.
No, I didn't know him.
Okay. John, when you first arrived, tell me the sense of what you knew and understood or thought about the United States in Southeast Asia, and what the purpose was and why you were there, and what the overall mission was.
Well, actually, I really did think the mission was to, you know, that the communists were trying to take over the country, and our mission was, you know, part of the great strategy of containment, and that, you know, it seemed a little... It was pretty gray because of all the things you'd seen on television, you know, ever since the Diem overthrow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was obvious that it wasn't as clear cut as the mission they gave us. But we were there to establish, you know, to hold on to democracy and to hold back the communists. I mean, that was pretty much what they told us. And that's by the time I actually got there, I thought my deal was to be the best platoon leader I can and get as many people home as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how most of the people, I think that's probably the thought of most infantry people, even in World War II. I mean, it was, you know, I think maybe they had more of a mission, but once you get into the field, it gets a lot more personal than any kind of, matter of fact, there's almost no, I'd say the sense of a bigger purpose is just gone. It's just you and the people around you and, you know, doing what you're, you know, told to do so you can get it over with and go home.
Right.
And I think that's the sense. And in good units, I think it's the same sense as it is in bad units. It really isn't about the big picture. It's about how you treat each other and how well led you are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's kind of amazing that we can get people to do it. Sometimes you just think, you know, why? I don't know if it's as amazing now as it was during the Civil War. I just have no clue how they got those guys to do that. But it is a it's an amazing thing that what people will do because they bond with the people next to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
John, what was the typical day like for you when you were when you first arrived and
field? When I first arrived, it was just pain. I was hot. I was tired. I wasn't in good shape because, as I say, I had I'd actually had 45 days off. I'd spent a little over 2 weeks down in Panama at jungle school, but I had and so I got 15 days travel time because I knew how to work the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had 30 days off, 15 days off before I went to jungle school. I went to jungle school for, it took about 2.5 weeks, I think, by the time you got down there, went through the school and got out. And then I had 30 days off before I went to Vietnam. So I had partied pretty good, and I probably put on about 20 pounds, I think. I've been eating good, drinking a lot of beer.
Mm-hmm.
And I got over there, and then when you're first over there, you know, you don't do anything. You do some training. They take you to classes and teach you about the Geneva Convention and, you know, make sure you're familiar with the arms, take you through some booby trap trails where they simulate booby traps so you kind of have an idea of what to look like, look for, and get you acclimatized, and then they send you out in the field. And it was just, you know, and I never carried a pack that weighed that much. Don't know if I've ever been any place where you couldn't get a drink of water at some point if you ran out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, and you know, and you just knew, you don't know what's going to happen. I think the sense of the unknown is, I don't think it's as much when you're 23, 20 years old about, you know, worrying about getting killed. Is just you just aren't familiar with your environment and what's going to happen, and so you've got this sense of having to be on the alert all the time, and that's pretty draining.
Mm-hmm.
Getting to know the people, getting to be a new person. You know, it's hard to get accepted in a unit that's been out there for a while when you're coming in as an individual replacement.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a little easier as a lieutenant because they have to be nice to you. And some people were accepted pretty readily and some weren't. So you had that whole business about being new and trying to break into a tight group.
Mm-hmm.
And then just, as I say, the environment was just real tough. It, you know, it was hot, the bugs, there was, you know, people shooting at you, everybody was unfamiliar, it was just an alien environment. You just never seen anything like that in the United States, you know, where,
mm-hmm.
with the rice paddies and the mud huts and the people chewing betel nut. I mean, we were in a rural area there.
Mm-hmm.
So, they're really, I guess, Quang Ngai City was sort of a city, but we never got up there. We could see it from the distance occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty much, you know, small village, farming villages. And then you get in the mountains, and there was nothing. You know, there was just trails and NVA and occasional Montagnard village down someplace. And
mm-hmm.
So,
what would make one person more readily accepted by the men, or less accepted by the men?
I think after all this time, it's kind of hard to remember that. I know some people came in, and they might be from an area that some of the other guys were from, and that helped. If we had quite a few people from Michigan. If we get another person from Michigan into the platoon, that seemed to help. If they'd been to the same AIT, you know, where they had something in common and could talk to some people about it, we're a little bit on the macho side. It helped more than if you were a little bit more on the scholarly side. And then if you were just willing to do your part and not bitch and carry on, you got accepted more readily than. And then when something happened, if the person reacted well.
Mm-hmm.
That had a lot to do. If they didn't react well, it took a long time for people to, if they didn't react well in their first action.
Mm-hmm. Okay. John, let me stop the recording just for a moment
to
change the disc. Okay, John, picking up. How were you accepted? I mean, how did you react, and how did you, with the criteria you just gave me, How did you fit into that?
Well, it's kind of funny because I got there in the dark. It was night when I got there, and so my platoon sergeant had seen me, and I'd met the other officers, one of whom I'd been to Officer Basic with, a fellow named Brad Burgraff, and so that was kind of nice to actually see a face that we weren't real good friends, but we knew each other. We were acquaintances, and so that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
And then we walked off LZ Thunder at about 3:30 in the morning, and I think I may have mentioned this, and I wasn't really assigned to a platoon because the company commander was out, and they said, this will be your platoon, so why don't you hang out with them? And so I was just sort of hanging out, and and I couldn't figure out which platoon it was as everybody was walking by in the dark. And so I finally just decided, it looks like everybody's leaving. I need to get in. I fell off a rice paddy dike into the water, and all these guys were walking by.
Right.
And so we had this firefight the first day, and everybody, I just did what some, what actually his name was Fred Ragland, was one of my squad leaders who'd been there for a while. I just did what he told me, and that seemed to work out okay with everybody. And then came in the next day, and it was really hard to keep up with everybody because the company commander showed up. He'd been a recon platoon leader, and he thought that our company should, do like a recon platoon. He was just a real hard charger when it came to walking, and so it was real difficult keeping up. And then about the third day I was there, we got in another firefight. It was sort of an interesting deal. Me and the platoon sergeant were the only ones in it for a while because he was showing me how to find tunnels and showed me this one he thought was empty, and it turned out there was people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out okay. And after that, it seemed like every day things got a little bit better. And I was pretty good about asking people what we should be doing because they teach you a lot of things, but a lot of times that doesn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to listen to people and learn things, and I think they appreciated that. The one strike I had going against me was I was an ROTC officer, and
right.
and their reputation wasn't as good usually as an OCS or a West Point person for whatever reasons. But after I'd been there about 3 weeks, it was fine. And I had a great platoon sergeant. He was a character, but he pretty much took care of his officers and pretty much ran the platoon. I mean, he'd been the acting platoon leader probably more than he had in the different times. And until I got my feet on the ground, it was, he would include me in all the things, but he'd say, well, I think this is what we should be doing, sir, he was just a character.
This is the gentleman that recently passed away?
Yes, Sergeant William Wright. And he was a Hawaiian. He looked like he was Vietnamese, and he'd come up and talk to him, and he was a real small man, and it really would irritate him. He was just a character, but and he'd actually shoot at people if they start bunching up too much together, and he was just a wild man and had absolutely no fear and seemed to have like some sort of protective shield around him. I mean, he was just, and like I said, that was his, he'd been on a combat tour. He was in Korea in 53, and when he was like 18, 19 years old, and so, he'd actually seen combat before he was there, and he trained this platoon in Hawaii, so this was had been his platoon all along, sort of like, John Wayne and Sands of Iwo Jima or something, so they were his people, and he was good. He was really good, but he was hard. And, they all, whenever we get together, we used to tell Sergeant Wright stories, because he was just absolutely just not playing with the full deck, it seemed like sometimes, but
effective.
But oh yeah, and everybody, nobody wanted a different platoon sergeant. Half of them hated him just because he was, he'd cancel somebody's promotion over an argument with about a can of spaghetti in your sea rations. I've actually seen him do that to people and just do almost bizarre things. But there was never any question that he was the platoon sergeant. And company commander, he was actually the acting first sergeant in the field. He was the field first, besides being our platoon sergeant, because he was just he was a great combat soldier. So that made things, I think, easy. Having a good infrastructure within the platoon had really good squad leaders and a good platoon sergeant, and so and the first month I was there, we didn't hit anything that was too big. We ran patrols. We'd run into a few Viet Cong occasionally, some snipers and things, and so I think that gave me some time to grow into the job a little bit. And so by the time in mid-September, where we actually did see some heavier combat, that things were, everybody had a sense of how we were going to do things and what I was going to do and what he was going to do, and we worked together most of the time. So,
okay. What about any race issues?
We in our platoon, and I can't really speak for, well, I can, I said something to you. Out in the field, we just didn't have, when I first got there, the platoon leader, I realized that I had a squad of blacks and a squad of, where most of the Hispanics were in, and then a squad of, and a half of mostly white people. And I was asking Sergeant Wright about that, and he said, well, that's how the guys wanted to do it, and the former platoon leader led them. And I said, well, I don't like this. And he said, neither do I, so we broke it up. And there was a little bitching by two or three of the fellows, and the Hispanic guy had two Puerto Ricans that came and claimed they couldn't speak English. And I said, well, I don't know how you got two basic training in AIT and this far in the Army. And I said, if you don't understand English, you're probably going to die. And because I said, I don't speak Spanish, and we're going to give the orders in English here, that was fine. They after that never heard any more about it. It was just sort of a test, and some of the black guys didn't want to get broken up. But I had a Hispanic two Hispanic squad leaders. One was from Puerto Rico, and one was from California, and two black squad leaders, and they were all really good. Three of them were shake and bakes, that came out of the NCO OCS school in Fort Benning, where they just trained people to be rifle squad leaders. I mean, they didn't really. And when you came out, you were either an E5 or an E6, and so they really, they could read maps, they could do all the stuff you need to know in combat. They probably wouldn't have been a great sergeant in a garrison situation, but they were bright, and you had to be pretty bright, and they could have gone to OCS, but you had to make a longer commitment if you did that. Really fortunate, I think, had good people, they'd been there for a while, and so when we broke them up, we never really had any racial problems in the field or really in the rear in the platoon. We had a tight group, and in the company there was very little. In the rear areas, back in Duck Fo, and especially up at Chulai, there were some real racial issues. They would have bands of blacks roaming the beach at Chulai at night beating up people, and bands of whites looking for blacks. I mean, it was almost like gangs sometimes up there at night. They had an incident after I was out of the field where they finally got a standout, went to Chulai, and a group of black soldiers attacked one of our white guys outside a little NCO club. Somebody saw it going on, and both the black and the white fellows from the company went out and, defended him and beat up one of some MPs that came and tried to break the things up. It was a kind of a bad situation, but I mean, it was the rifle company itself was a really, really tight group. I went over, they made me B company commander for a little while after we got a bunch of new officers, and I think I was B company commander for 3 days, and then they got some even more captains in, and so lost that job, and that's how I got brigade headquarters. But when I got there, they had a lot seemed to have a lot more trouble over at Bravo Company than we did, and that there was a whole bunch of, I guess the proper word is malingerers, in the rear that were refusing to go to the field, and they were almost all black guys and said that the NCOs and the company commander didn't treat them right and they weren't going to go. And so I sent some of them to jail and some of them went to the field. But I don't know how that turned out because, as I say, I was company commander for a total of 3 days, took care of that, and then the new fellow showed up, so at least he didn't have to deal with it. But right. But there were, by late 68, early 69, there was a lot of problems in the rear areas where you worked maybe 10 hours a day, did some guard duties, and then you had time. And when you've got that many young men together, and if the wrong people, become the leaders of a group, you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about all I know about that.
Okay. Can you tell me about when you would actually go out into the field, kind of your day-to-day activities and the tactics you all employed and kind of what a typical day was like out there?
Well, a typical day when things were... when we were down in the coastal areas, we actually had two areas we operated in. We operated in the coastal plain, which was all paddies, a lot of hedgerows that would break up the paddies and surround the villages, and then villages and an occasional road. We had Highway 1 that ran along the coast. We had the South China Sea, and then at the bottom of our area of operations, the mountains actually came down and touched the sea. That's where the mountains actually come down and hit the ocean in Vietnam. And that was, we were right at the I Corps, II Corps border. And that was one of the reasons in 69 and 70 there was a lot of activity in our area because the NVA kept trying to cut the country. And that was the logical place to try to do it because you had cover all the way to the coast. And then the mountains would gradually sweep back till they were probably 15 miles in from the coast, and then the mountains would start and you have some foothills and then taller mountains behind. And of course, we used to always think when you go in the mountains, we were on the Laotian or Cambodian border. That was always the rumor. And I've even noticed in some of my letters, I said, we're not too far from Cambodia. We were a long way from Cambodia. But at the time, it seemed like you'd think, my gosh, we're out in the middle of nowhere. So the tactics varied a little bit from, depending on the terrain you were operating in.
Of course.
But most of the time, a typical day would be we'd get up, we would have dug in the night before, and usually late in the afternoon, so we'd have plenty of time to dig in fairly well. We were really good about digging in. The company had seen enough action earlier. They believed in having been mortared enough. They believed in having foxholes. Some of the companies that hadn't seen as much, you'd see them, and they'd try to sneak in and lay up at night, So they always thought that, talked to one of the company commanders. We got in an argument later on, and we were out in the jungle, and we were digging in, and you make a lot of noise when you're digging in and cutting fields of fire and things. We were supposed to be setting up together, and he thought that they should just sneak in and lay down so the NVA wouldn't know where you were. And my theory was they knew where we were because we made so much noise moving. 100 Americans loaded down with gear are not a particularly quiet group.
Even with noise discipline.
Yeah, noise discipline, and there's just no way that when you were out in the mountains and you're following trails looking for base camps or whatever, that they don't have some trail watch. When you hit somebody earlier in the day, they've got a general sense that somebody's out there. And our theory was we're going to make it worthwhile for we're going to not make it worth their while to come after us. And if they do, we want to be dug in. And we'd seen a lot of action earlier than this.
How would you set up your defensive perimeter and when you would dig in?
Mainly it was a perimeter. We usually set it up as close to a circle as we could make it. We'd literally be a perimeter. We'd find the highest ground we could, dig in on the military crest someplace, which always, you know, sometimes when you go over in a helicopter, you could see every hill, especially down in the coastal plain, look like a garbage dump because there was sea ration cans and things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mortars and the CP would be in the center of the perimeter, but you'd have one platoon tying into the other platoon tying in, and then the shape would be generally round, and you set up the machine guns on the most likely avenues of approach into your area and where they could, you know, kind of cover the front of the platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would set out claymores and trip flares. That was something else we carried. I forgot to mention. Everybody carried a claymore and a trip flare.
Mm-hmm.
And we would set those out. And then usually had two men, sometimes three if we had enough people, to a position. And the size of the perimeter often depended on how many men we had in the field, unless we had an area where you had to spread out a lot wider.
Mm-hmm.
to cover the likely avenues of approach. We like to be as tight as we could sometimes, but we varied anywhere. I think we had as many as 125 men in the field with a table of organization called for 156, I think, in a light infantry company.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you take out the people that are in the rear, 125 in the field is pretty much a full complement. Now, that counted some artillery people and stuff, so they'd probably be actually about 115 or so from the company.
Okay.
And then we'd be down, we were down as low as 50 several times. So, and of course, they always expected you to cover the same amount of ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was always kind of difficult. But we would normally find a good spot and dig in 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 5, depending on when it was going to get dark. It'd be usually start digging in about 2 hours or so before dark. So we could have a good hole and set up and put out, and if we, depending on where we were, we put out listening posts sometimes, which would be usually two men, you know, out from the perimeter someplace on each side on the likely avenues of approaches. Or a lot of times, and that would be, okay, we're in the whole company there. A lot of times what would happen is we'd dig in with one platoon around the CP, and the other two platoons would split up and go out on ambushes. We'd put out sometimes as many as 10 or 12 small ambushes every night and, you know, spread all over a whole area when we were down in the coastal plain. And that's pretty much a lot of what we did down there. And then we'd get back together in the daytime and then patrol as a unit, you know, kind of spread out, put two platoons in front going, you know, searching an area, you know, sweeping through an area and one kind of in reserve, you know, pulling in from the rear,
mm-hmm.
and with the CP in the middle, and usually spread out over, you know, a half a mile or so, you know, in width, following the, you know, the rice paddy. They tell you never to walk on the dikes, you know, that's one of the things we taught you. And of course, we always walked on dikes, as, you know, try to walk in a rice paddy with 80 pounds on your back, and then the second thing is, The Vietnamese were walking on the dikes, and so it was usually, if you were down in a populated area, if you'd seen Vietnamese walking in an area, it was probably safe. You know, we'd hit a booby trap occasionally, but in the Duc Pho area, that wasn't real often at one time. We'd get some sniper fire, but...
Mm-hmm.
So we patrolled at night, and...
Tell me about that. Tell me about the ambushes that you would run at night.
Well... when we didn't get lost, sometimes we'd find something. When I first got there, it just drove me nuts because, you'd be out there in the dark and there's no landmarks and you're out on this perfectly flat rice paddy broken up by hedgerows and there was nothing to see and so you started off and if you ended up getting mixed up, you had, you know, no clue where you were. It took me a while to get used to navigating in the rice paddies. That was just a real mess. But the we would go out usually with around five men. So there'd be if you had a platoon, you'd put out maybe 6 ambushes at night. And sometimes they'd leave the machine guns in with the company, and sometimes you'd take one of the assign a gun to one of the ambushes, and the platoon leader would take one, the platoon sergeant would take one, and the squad leaders would take one. And so you usually have 5 or 6 out at night, and you'd go out anywhere from a kilometer to 6 or 7 kilometers from where the company was dug in. And you'd try to leave after dark, you know, so they wouldn't see you, or before dark, and stop someplace and then go to your ambush site after it got dark, and set up, pretty much cover a trail or a junction of 2 large paddy dikes, or mm-hmm. watch a village or do something. And most of the time you never saw anything. And the thing that you had to worry about is if you weren't where you were supposed to be, they had Agent Iron fire, harassment and interdiction fire, the artillery fired at night, and those were at random targets. And you know, if you were in the wrong place, and you didn't know where those were coming in at, they didn't tell you. They just told you you're supposed to be here, and the artillery would know not to fire into that area. And so that always worried me that when I first got there, that I was lost, and we'd be sitting under some H&I target. Mm-hmm. Never happened, but it was a concern. And sometimes people, if they get lost, they just hunker down, and we would have patrols, I know, that would do what you call sandbag. They'd go out 200 yards and find a kind of a covered position and really not go out to where they were supposed to go. Occasionally, if you'd been in a lot of bad combat and you were down with not too many people, you'd have certain squad leaders or platoon sergeants or somebody that would sandbag the patrol rather than go out and risk, you know, if you hit a lot of combat, risk being overrun in a small group by a bunch of NVA.
How often did that happen in your position?
You know what? You don't know. You'd hear about it afterwards. Somebody, you know, you'd hear somebody say, oh, so-and-so sandbagged the patrol last night. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it happened real often, but I would say, and it really depended on how much combat you'd seen up before that and how thin they were making the patrols go out. It got to be almost an individual decision on the part of the patrol leader if they thought they were going to go out and get their, you know, get hung out to dry someplace with no support, where they really might run into something bad. Sometimes they would sandbag. And most of the time, I don't think the company commanders knew about it, and the platoon leaders would only sort of hear about it after the fact, you know, later on. And there's no way to prove that. We had a bad incident outside of Hawthorne, the Special Forces camp, and there's 2 versions of what happened. And one was that the patrol sandbagged, and they were just outside the perimeter when the NVA hit us, and so they got caught in between. And the other one was the NVA, they were trying to get back into the perimeter, and they got overrun. And I don't know which one's true.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, I don't know. I just know we lost the whole group. But it almost, knowing the people, that was a different platoon, knowing the people and some of the stuff that was going on there, I almost believed the first rumor that they tried to stick around till just before dark and were going to sneak out because they didn't feel safe. We'd run into a lot of NVA sign. There'd been a lot of combat going on in the area, and you know, the platoon leader over there, I'm not sure they had a whole lot of faith in their platoon leader. He was way too gung-ho for a lot of the people. Didn't think things through very well, and just, I'm in charge, and this is what you'll do.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what were the differences between the daytime and the nighttime when you think back in general about that?
The daytime you were hot and miserable, and you felt better, you know, because you could see, and we didn't have all the night vision devices that they have now,
mm-hmm.
And of course, there was a lot more, you know, you're out, there was a lot more cover than there has been in the last 2 or 3 wars. Fields of fire weren't as good. And so you're moving at night, and I mean, it was just kind of like a cat and mouse game. I mean, we were out trying to set up ambushes, and we knew they were doing the same thing. You know, they were moving at night, and I never, you know, used to hear that thing about Charlie rules the night, you
yes.
know. And we didn't move as much at night, but we ambushed a lot at night, and we never felt that they were any better at night than we were. They just knew where they were. You know, the big advantage they had was knowing the terrain. You know?
Right.
Now, and that was an advantage they had down in the coastal plains. Up in the mountains, nobody knew where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And so the NVA and the Americans, I think, in the mountains were pretty much on equal terms, except we were moving around a lot more than they tended to, and so we'd blunder into them, you know. Or I hate to say blunder, because most of the time we didn't know where they were.
Right.
We'd just go out and look for them, and sometimes you'd run into them. And often, of course, the NVA would have Viet Cong that would lead them through the coastal plain. So, you know, they knew where they were going, where they wanted to set up, and we were just out kind of wandering around looking for somebody to run into.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by late 68, the body count mentality was starting to come in, you know. So
right.
People would, well, how many kills did you get today, you know? Or
they would ask you that.
The kill ratios. Well, I mean, that was a big deal. They kept track of it. They would know, oh, that's your fifth kill for this month or something, you know. And I think we had a pretty good outfit. I think, you know, we didn't count somebody unless you could kick the body, and very seldom we ever kill people that didn't have weapons. And so, I mean, I think we had pretty good, one of the reasons we had good morale is because we were out there trying to be soldiers, I think, most of the time. And I think most people felt pretty good about what,
mm-hmm.
you know, what we were doing. We were out there to fight, not looking for, you know, try to keep things under control, not burning villages and doing stuff.
Right.
And it's hard to do sometimes in certain areas.
What did you think of that body count policy?
I thought it sucked. And what happened is it was more in the brigade, battalion, division headquarters. And what would happen, they would put pressure on lower units, and so you would get this really in 69, and after I got into the brigade intelligence, because that was one thing we were supposed to, you know, track, you could see what was going on. We had a cab outfit that we worked with, and they were really bad about it. And I think what they would do is they kill one NVA, and they'd have five guys in the track, and they'd ask each one of them how many dead people they saw, and they'd say one. Say, okay, the five guys saw one dead person, that's five.
Right.
And I truly believe that we probably killed a lot more than we claimed, but a lot of it was going out places where we didn't have combat troops. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you interrogate the North Vietnamese, they'd come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I mean, the attrition on the infiltration groups from bombing and artillery and stuff was incredible, but we never knew, you know, that. But there was this, you know, somehow we wanted to know whether we were winning or not, and that's a pretty poor way to find out, you know, so it never worked. But certainly I know we had a brigade commander for a while, Colonel Donaldson, that was very anxious to make general, and he was just obsessed with having a good kill ratio and a good body count.
Mm-hmm.
This
is when you were back at the headquarters?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. When I was out in the field, I mean, we really didn't have to worry about too much. We kept running into them. So
right.
And I think so. But it was a bad policy, and I know they wanted to know some way, but it also encouraged people, I think, sometimes to either take credit for things they didn't do, or, you know, to start firing up places where they didn't need to sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what do you think of the 1-year rotation policy, especially as an officer who would, you know, usually spend 6 months in the field, 6 months out?
Yeah, I loved it when I was there because I knew we were going home. I mean, there was a good sense of morale. There was a good thing to it from that standpoint, that people knew they weren't going to be there forever. And, of course, the war had been going on for so long, I don't think anybody wanted to be there for the duration plus six. And there was lots of people that never had to go. You know, I knew people that spent their whole tour in Germany or something, you know, in the infantry. And the other thing that went on with, and, of course, the bad thing was that once you started getting short, as they said, you know, you had 4 months to go or 3 months to go or 2 months to go. All of a sudden, you know, people didn't want to go on patrol. They didn't, from that standpoint, it was a good morale builder for about the first 8 months, and then it was pretty negative. The other bad thing, I say, especially think from the officer standpoint, is about the time you learned what you were doing, they pulled you out.
Right.
So I suspect that, you know, I really didn't have a good idea about what I was doing until I'd been in the field for, you know, 6 weeks or so and seen enough action to have an idea of how to react to things and what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, about 2 months later, they get in this whole influx of new officers, and I'm the senior lieutenant in the battalion, and they pull me out, senior lieutenant in the field. And of course the other bad thing about that, especially about the thing with the officers, were, you know, the ordinary grunts spent their whole tour in the field.
Right.
And there was some resentment for that. If they liked you, they were happy that you were getting out. And if they didn't like you, they were resentful, about the policy. I mean, everybody over there, when somebody, I don't think anybody ever resented somebody getting out of the field there. They thought it was good for them, especially if it was somebody they liked. They say, well, good for you, you're going to make it home, you know. So it worked both ways. The other bad thing that the Army did, I think, in Vietnam, and you may see, again, if this thing protracts for a long time in Iraq and Afghanistan, is that once you had experience, they tended to rotate those same officers back in there. I knew people that were on their fourth tour.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's officers in Germany and the United States that had never been to Southeast Asia. And so there was this sense that once, in fact, it wasn't a sense, it was absolutely true. Once you had combat experience, they kept rotating you back in. And that wasn't good on the morale of the officer corps at all, because there was resentment to the fact, well, I did my tour, and there's all, you know, three quarters of the officer's corps have never been, and they're sending me back.
Right.
So,
how about tension between those in the rear and those who spent their time mostly in the field?
There was a lot of tension there. We did not like the people in the rear. Actually, we may have disliked them more than the NVA. At least you respected the NVA. They were all out there suffering and doing stuff. I mean, you may not like them, but, you know, and of course, I'm sure you know the expression from having talked to a lot of people. You know, we call them all rimps.
Right.
And to this day, I suspect, even though it's better, but, you know, there was just a lot of resentment by the men in the field of the men in the rear. And partially it was because in a lot of cases, looked down on the field troops.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you'd go up into Chulai or someplace, and the MPs would start giving, you know, it was supposed to be their job, but they'd start giving the guys a hard time because their hair wasn't cut or they didn't have their uniform all up, you know, the snuff exactly or something. And sometimes, you know, if your hair was, you know, down way over your collar or something, you know, that's a problem with the company. But, I mean, you just really resented the fact that you had these people that were back there getting their three squares a day and sleeping on a bed and stuff, you know, mm-hmm. giving you a hard time. And I think that was the case probably in every war. And it may be a little bit more in Vietnam than other places. I'm not sure that it's worse there than in other places, but
why would those in the rear resent you all out in the field?
Well, they didn't resent us. We resented them. They sort of looked down on the people. They thought, well, you know, all the dummies are out there in the field, and And you would have people that would say, well, you know, they should have attacked harder. You know, you get, you know, well, why didn't you guys do this? Why didn't you guys do that? It was like, you know, it was sort of a game with them, and they couldn't figure out why. You know, you'd get back there and they'd say, well, you know, these guys aren't very well motivated. They're a bunch of slackers and stuff. We had a company clerk in our own company that had to take off a chew law every time he heard some people were coming in because there's supposedly a contract out. And because he would, like, people he didn't like, he'd tear up their, you know, their in-country R&R orders.
Wow.
Say they didn't deserve to be that. I had to send people back one time. They were sending guys in the monsoon when I was CO out to the field with wool blankets.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew for a fact that back in the rear areas, they were using poncho liners for curtains and bedspreads, you know, because they looked nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to put some people on a resupply helicopter, send them back in, and literally go through the battalion rear with their rifles, pulling down first sergeants and armorers' curtains and bedspreads, and because they were saying, well, you can't do that, that's our stuff, you know.
Wow.
And I had people out there that they had wool blankets, and when they get wet, you know, I mean,
yeah.
And so there was just stuff like that happened all the time. You know, we had a somebody was taking all the beer and soda and selling it to the villagers, and we couldn't get it.
Mm.
And, you know, we were supposed to get one beer and one soda in the field every day. And we were having to buy them from the villagers because there wasn't any rear because this guy was selling them to the villagers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were paying $1 for something we were supposed to be getting free.
Mm.
And there was just lots of they'd send guys out with backpacks instead of rucksacks, the boards, you know,
mm-hmm.
with the strings on them, and because they were doing something with, you know, they were trading a rucksack someplace. I mean, there's just a lot of that goes on and went on. And
so you all actually had conversations with the people back in the rear when you would go back up and you would confront each other. They would actually talk about you all being slackers or being dummies for being on the field. Or you're not doing
there were some. Actually, most people wouldn't do that to people's face.
Okay,
but when you get back in, you hear that stuff. Sometimes you're one or two at a time, because you know the people the guys in the field. A lot of times, you know, they come back in and their attitude wouldn't be really good if somebody would say something like that to them.
Mm-hmm.
But there was just that general sense back there that almost a sense of superiority that, you know, the lower classes are out there and, you know, we're better off for being back
mm-hmm.
here. And there was a lot more drug use, especially in 68 back in the rear
mm-hmm.
than there was in the field. There was just a lot of morale in the rear areas was not as good as it was in the field in
mm-hmm.
late 68, which is kind of a weird deal. But
well, speaking of having a contract out on somebody, what kind of incidents or discussion of fragging did you ever hear about?
Actually, I didn't hear about any of that really until part way through 69. I think once, you know, it became obvious that we were going to pull out, there was just a lot more resentment. There was a little bit had gone on in up in Chulai. He'd heard some rumors that, you know, something had happened.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have much at Duck Pho. We had some shooting incidents, but most of that was over somebody, you know, getting mad in an argument. As far as I know, we hadn't had any incidents where somebody had actually come in and intentionally killed somebody else, you know. And in the field, there was rumors of platoon leaders or somebody being shot, but usually that was a competence deal and not a discipline thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where somebody was disciplining somebody and they resented it. When I first got to Korea in 71, there was a lot of it going on. We were up in the DMZ,
mm-hmm.
and there was fraggings going on every day up there practically.
Really? Why?
People were on drugs. You'd go out, they were giving them live ammunition, putting them on out in the trenches, you know, on the DMZ at night, 8 hours, and they'd be out there doing drugs. And they'd come in and, you know, some sergeant would say something to them they didn't like, and they'd just kill them.
Wow.
Or some officer. I mean, I actually slept with a 45 under my pillow the first couple of months I was there. It was just literally a lot of it going on. And that was one of the reasons they pulled us off the DMZ. That wasn't the official reason, but that was, I always thought that was a major reason they pulled us back, because they wanted to take the live ammunition away from people. But now in 68, at least in our brigade, you didn't hear much.
Okay. What about tension between draftees and those who enlisted and or were regular military?
There was a lot of joking that went on about, you know, being lifers and stuff.
Right.
And there was a little bit, you know, of tension, I guess, but I don't recall that being a major area of is the main thing people were worried about, at least in our outfit, was whether somebody was competent or not.
Okay.
I mean, they weren't worried about, you know, it's like Sergeant Wright, he was definitely a lifer, and they all called him, well, you lifer. You know, the draftees would get upset when he wanted them to do something and refer to him as a lifer, not necessarily to his face, but, you know, you'd hear him talking. But the fact that he was, right, you know, was competent, that was the thing that people worried about the most. There was a rumor that one of our lieutenants was shot in the leg by one of his guys in a firefight, and I don't know if that was true or not. Nobody, you know, it's one of those things you heard once or twice, and some people would say, well, I don't know if that's true or not. You know, you just don't know. And the guy just would freeze up in a firefight. And they liked him. He was a likable guy. And so the rumor was they got in this big firefight, and one of the fellows shot him in the leg, so he gets to get him out of the field, but they didn't want to kill him.
Right.
And so, you know, and as I say, I don't know if that's true, but it makes almost too much sense not to believe, because the whole circumstance was always a little strange about the deal. So, yeah, and I still know him to this day, and he doesn't think that, you know. So,
right. What about friendly fire incidents?
I don't think there's any such thing as friendly fire. I can't believe that, you know, they won't give people Purple Hearts because they're killed by our own artillery. I don't know if they still do that. We had some incidents. We had two or three, actually. One up in the mountains, where we had an artillery LNO, and I later found out, that it was with battalion, you know, flew around with the battalion commander up in his command and control chopper. And I understand the battalion commander made him write L and R on the back of his hands, because he couldn't remember left from right when he was calling artillery in. And he called in artillery on us once. And we actually had about 12 guys hit, 12 or 13, but none of them were serious. We were up in the real deep trees. And so, you know, everybody got up next to a trunk someplace, and we were lucky nobody got hit real bad. We got a bunch of guys who were cut, you know, pretty badly. And I was acting company commander at the time. We were actually in contact, so I put them all in for a Purple Heart, because I couldn't, and reported it as being from grenade fragments. And they were really unhappy with me about that, because they were pretty sure that that wasn't it.
Who was unhappy with you?
The battalion staff. They kept trying to, you know, get me to change my story.
Did they get the Purple Hearts?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they didn't have a choice, because we, you know, we called them in from the field as having been wounded during contact with enemy forces. And we'd run into two trail. We'd had one man killed, and we'd run point man had been killed and shot in the leg, and actually went in shock and bled to death before we could get to him. And we were pushing these two guys back in the trees, and the battalion commander, we were calling artillery in behind them. There may have been three, but we were calling in by sound because you couldn't see anything. And he got in a hurry to try to cut them off and had this fella call in artillery and called it right in on top of us. And of course, he was pretty sure that that's what happened, because there hadn't been any firing for couple of minutes, but I just called everybody in for the Purple Heart. I figured, you know, I was pretty upset.
I can imagine.
And they all got it, because we, you know, just told them, you know, we were in contact with the enemy. They were throwing grenades, and two grenades went off, and we were just lucky we didn't have anybody seriously wounded, didn't have to dust anybody off. And we had another incident where they dropped one right into the middle of the perimeter one time. And we were lucky everybody was in the hole because we were calling in, setting up final protective fires for the night. And but it hit right, I don't know, maybe 15 yards from the CP. And if everybody hadn't been down in the foxholes, we would have had several people hit. So, so and those are two I remember. And, I mean, it was just one of those things you worried about all the time.
Right. John, tell me about your experiences with the dust-off teams.
They were good and bad. Some of them would come in, you know, right in the middle of things, and some of them... You had trouble, you know, if you were in a firefight, or had been in one recently. If you didn't call them in as an urgent, they wouldn't want to send people in. Or if you changed your mind, we had trouble one time where we called in one as a routine, not realizing the fellow had been hit as bad as he was, and changed it to an urgent. And they weren't going to send, you know, they said no, he called it in as routine. That was it. And we had to threaten to send some people after the dispatcher, and they showed up, and it turned out fine. He's fine now, well, I think, because we got him out of there. But for dust offs, we love dust offs. I mean, I'm giving you the good and bad news. The news was almost always good. I mean, they you know, if it hadn't been for that, we'd have a lot more guys who wouldn't have made it home. And you know, they get them up to the hospital. The medics are great. You just can't really say enough about the medics and the doctors and the people because and the medics on the dust offs. I mean, those guys were just amazing. And I'll tell you, we had some of our command and control pilots that were with Brigade Aviation, and they would come in just time after time under fire to pick up wounded guys if the dust offs were all filled up. And I had a lot of respect for those guys. I worked with a lot of them after I got out of the field. But we'd had command and control choppers come in and picked up people when we couldn't get a dust off to come in sometimes. And so, you know, some of the chopper pilots were just amazing, and some of them were like the guy that drop the, you know, C rations on us weren't. So,
right.
But a dust off is the sweetest sight in the world after you've been in, you know, been in a big firefight.
Right. How would you rate the intelligence that you received? And obviously I'm asking you who served as an intelligence
officer. Later on, we got a lot smarter after I got out of the field. Most of the time, it was sort of general and not very good. And when I say that, you had a general sense that something was going on, but you never know where it was. And I didn't find it. When I was actually out in the field, had very little idea, but other than, you know, company commander would say, okay, they say this, you know, 48th. Main 4th Battalion is out operating in this area, and we're going to go out and find them, okay? When we went up to Hawthorne in September and gotten all the contact, we knew there was people up there because the 3rd and 1st had already been up there for a week, and, you know, we were getting all the reports back about all the combat. So most of the time, it was just that they're out there someplace. We know that they're doing something. Let's go out and see if we can find them. Wouldn't have any idea how they'd be armed, you know, other than the fact they've got AK-40, you know, they always seem to have the same things. If you ran into MDA, they were armed one way. If you ran into VC, they could be armed any number of ways, you know.
Right.
So most of the time we just felt like we were blundering around in the dark until we found somebody. When I got into the brigade intelligence shop, It seemed like, you know, we certainly tried to be organized, and we had lots of information that we mapped out, and some of it was accurate and some of it wasn't. A lot of the information you got was sort of almost like hearsay. We would map out anything that was actually spotted by long-range reconnaissance patrols, people like that, you know, and then try to match it with things we were hearing from the through the Vietnamese or the CIA people or whoever. And sometimes it would be pretty accurate, but you had a problem with if the vision thought something different, there was a lot of times that I thought the vision intelligence wasn't as good as it should be, and we had the post unit, you know, enemy unit sites on the maps. They like the, our first brigade commander made us do it by weather division because they were obviously smarter than we were. And we would get something called, usually reliable intelligence, URIs. It, there was obviously some sort of radio intercepts. And that stuff would be pretty good. It would be some sort of headquarters unit, usually. And they were usually out in the mountains someplace. And you'd start getting them and you'd get a whole bunch. And they'd actually identify the unit, but they wouldn't tell you, you know, there was radio intercepts or, you know, whatever it was. It was a big dark secret. There was these people up in this little thing surrounded by barbed wire, and the guy would come out and mark our maps for us, you know. And you'd talk to him, and he, you know, I can't tell you what it is. But, you know, I mean, you could figure it out. And the amazing thing was they obviously had intelligence coming from the South Vietnamese, because if we would plan for, like, a B-52 strike in that area, about 6 or 8 hours before the B-52 strikes would start hitting, you'd see these things start moving out of the boxes.
Okay.
And, but, you know, sometimes, occasionally we'd get lucky, you know, and get something, and you'd put two or three things together and we would catch somebody, you know. But a lot of the time, it was just, you had general information and you just had to go out and look for them, and they'd be pretty widely separated out there. You know, there's a lot of territory and not that many people would cover it. And a lot of cover. I mean, you could, you know, you could be on the wrong side of a hill and there probably could have been an NVA regiment on the other side. And as long as they were being quiet and didn't move, you know, you wouldn't see them.
Right, right.
So,
did your unit ever use canine units?
Yeah, actually the first month I was in the field, we used one several times, and I laughed because they were good at finding booby traps and things. They would do that, but it, when it was really hot, they couldn't keep up. The dogs would get tired,
right?
And it would actually slow you down, and so anybody that might be around could take off. I mean, the dogs were really bad when it was hot. And the only times I ever operated with them, it was hot. And the dog handlers were kind of wild men. They were a little different. And the guys would want to feed the dogs because, you know, they were big dogs and nice dogs. And the handlers would go crazy. And the people, then they'd have to, you know, the guys would feed the dogs anyway. And then they'd have to take them back and retrain them, they'd tell me. You know, they were... we had some trouble. We had a dog handler unit we're pretty sure killed a South Vietnamese soldier, and we don't know if they did by accident or not, and they tried to cover it up, and then they tried to blame it on one of our people, and that was kind of a bad incident. They went into this little villa with three or four guys and pulled out this guy that was in kind of a green uniform and shot him. And then they found out he was a member of, like, the regional forces or something. He had an ID card on him, and they threw it away. And the people from the village, I guess, and they turned him in as having been a, you know, a Viet Cong main force guy. And we didn't know any different. The people that were with him, I don't know if they actually saw him throw the ID card away. He never got real clear about that. But what later on, the people from the village complained, they investigated it, called these guys up, and they tried to claim that our artillery sergeant that was assigned with our artillery forward observer had actually done it. And we had several other people that knew that wasn't the case, but they had a trial and some things. And, but they were kind of the dog handlers were all kind of they were kind of wild people, you know, and they just seemed like they were a little out on the edge all the time compared to us. But we worked with dogs probably 2 weeks in August. And it was a lot of fun, you know, having them with us. And they would sniff out, you know, they'd find some tunnels, and they were always empty and some things. But But mostly the thing that I remember was the dogs couldn't keep up.
Okay.
So.
Did you all use snipers?
No.
Okay.
Didn't have any snipers.
Okay. Did you work with troops from other countries? Australian, New Zealanders, ROCs?
No, we ran into a minefield that had been laid by the ROCs that they didn't mark once. That wasn't good. Anyway, that's what I was told later on happened. They were all bouncing Bettys, and they were all around an old R, you know, a night defensive position.
Right.
And we later heard that the up at division, they knew about it. The ROCs had laid it, and they forgot to tell us. And I don't know, but that's... I think the ROCs had laid it because they were all bouncing Bettys. I mean, they were all American-made bouncing Betty mine, and they were laid out, you know, like you would lay out a minefield, and the ROCs would do that.
Mm-hmm.
This was out on, you know, out in the Pinkfield in the Batanian Peninsula area.
What about Arvin?
Worked with Arvin a couple of times. That was never real successful. Worked with the regional forces a few times. That was even less successful. The Arvins just weren't very well motivated. We actually had the first Arvin division, I think it was the first, between us and the rest of the AmeriCal division. They were up around Quang Ngai City. And occasionally we and they were they'd go out and burn villages. I could understand why the people didn't care for the national police. And most of my dealings with the national police and the Arvins were not very positive. So we didn't like working with them. I don't know if we actually ever went on we'd set up a blocking force and they'd come into us or something occasionally, and that was about the extent of it.
Okay. John, how would you describe the quality of the communication that you had there within the platoon, within the company, and then going up the chain?
When you talk about communications, if you're talking about physical communications with radio, that most of the time that was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Communication, of course, I like to think communication within the platoon was good, but you know, you talk to the guys and they say, we never knew what was going on. And I would only, you know, and I'd have idea and tell the squad leaders whatever I knew or whoever, you know, and the company commander would, you know, tell us sort of what he thought we were supposed to know. But I never felt, and this was reinforced after I got out of the field, that the people up at the higher echelons, especially by the time you got to brigade, had a good feel for what was going on. I just don't think that they, the thing that, like, as I say, sometimes we had 52 men, and sometimes, and I know it probably doesn't matter to them, but, you know, they wouldn't look at what the field strength of a unit was in assigning missions. You know, it was this company given this mission, it was this, one of the things that amazed me was after having been out in the field is I knew the DNVA stayed down and mostly there had to be a stream where they would set up because they couldn't, you know, operate without water. And of course we could have water flown in, so we were always on, you know, on high places. And of course, military doctrine in almost any country says if you know, you control the high places, that's good. Well, you know, if you're out there living in the jungle, you might put, you know, some kind of listening post or trail watchers up in the high places, but you're going to have to be someplace where you can get the water and quite a bit of it. And one of the things I found out when I got in the rear, the fellow before me, and we didn't have anybody in the battalion staff, brigade staff, that actually operated in the area. And a lot of them had never actually been in the field, the lieutenant colonels and the colonels. And they were targeting all their stuff for the high ground.
Right.
And it took me a while to persuade them that, you know, when we finally would go out and show the colonel in some places that they were... You know, all the base camps and things when we started finding them were always in the low ground. And they finally let me start targeting some things, and we did a little better. And I'm not just bragging about that. It just I just never felt that they really had a sense of how the enemy operated. That was just a sense there at the 11th Brigade. I'm sure there was other places, you know, it would depend. And later on, we got a brigade commander that had worked his way up from private and was much better at that, you know, as far as giving the right kind of directives to the staff on how we should be operating.
Okay.
Can we
Absolutely.
Call it off?
Absolutely. Let me go ahead and stop the interview for today.